to the Black Doula Podcast with myself, Xavier Wade, aka the Black Doula. Today's episode features Biaga Tema Mercado, and we're going to be discussing midwifery and the body. So, Tema, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, sure. I go by Tema. My birth given name is Bianca Vanessa Quiñones de la Peña. I am a out of hospital birth community midwife. Partera. My father was Benigno Quiñones Ruiz of Yureme indigenous bloodline, coming from La Sierra of Sinaloa, northern Mexico. And my mother, Rosabelia Alvarez, is from Michoacan and the Nayarit regions of Mexico. I was born and raised in San Jose, California, and I currently reside in San Diego, California, in Kumeyaay Land, with my husband Omar and our six children and our one grandchild. So yeah, that's me.
So where do I even start? When I think I want to talk about your children because I just saw Mundo, and so I'm just like, can you give us your whole family description if you don't mind?
We have a blended family, but we always refer to our children as children, and our children, we always refer us to mom and dad. We don't use the term step, because we believe that in the end, you know, we are all our relations, and we never say you're my step friend or you're my step auntie. Yeah. So we are our family, but I gave birth the very first time when I was 16 years old. I was 15 when I was pregnant with my daughter, Jewel. I was 16 when I had her. And then at 22 years of age, I had another child, my now 16-year-old son, Andre. And I had them before I met my husband, Omar. And Omar had our daughter, Iyari, in his first marriage. Iyari is now 19 years old. She's about to turn 20. And our two oldest daughters, they live outside of the home now. So they're trying to do their thing, be adults, yeah. Calling mom and dad for support, you know.
Of course, coming over
for food. Right. We're letting them, you know, letting them go through it, you know, so that they can learn. But we're here for them. They know that they can always call us. So currently now in my home, it's just me and five men. So my husband, my 16-year-old son, Andre, and then we have Omar and I collectively together with our own set of chromosomes made Olin, who's 8, Emiliano, who's 6, and Mundo, who is 4.5 months. So it's me and five of them.
A lot. You're doing it.
Yeah.
So I think that's like, it was important to speak about, like, and ask you about your family. Obviously, our conversation is going to be about midwifery, but I also feel like there's such a close connection from like who we are as people into how we connect to birth work. So I guess my next question is, how did you become a midwife? What made you want to be a midwife?
There's so many ways that I could talk about this, but I'll talk about it in a way that I haven't before, just for your
podcast. I'm excited. Yeah, I'm excited. I know. Hopefully, I'm excited. Let's do it.
Yeah. When I was a little girl, I used to have a lot of dreams, and I used to have a lot of like spirit friends, or what people call imaginary friends. And one of them was an older woman with a long braid and black and like salty pepper kind of hair. And in my dream, she used to teach me things, and she would teach me a lot about plants, and she would take me to births with her. Okay. So these were dreams that I had when I was a little girl. I'm talking about less than 10 years of age. And I don't remember how many I had. I don't even remember talking to people about them. There were just, you know, you're a child, you have dreams. Sometimes you talk about them, sometimes you don't. Never made anything of them. I always thought, like, I would always think about parteras as a thing of the past, because in Mexico, they were criminalized just the way that they were here in the United States. But the suppression was really, it was very aggressive in Mexico. And the parteras that we knew existed were only amongst within their very tight indigenous communities, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought parteras were a thing of the past. And so I first started my careers in, I was a gang intervention specialist for several years, working in the barrios of San Jose. And I worked with female gang members, starting in middle school all the way into adulthood. And so naturally, you know, working in with a community who has faced like so much violence and trauma, mm-hmm. one of the things that was very common amongst my clients and the groups of young women that I worked with was sexual assault. And so from there, I stepped away from the gang intervention work life, and I started working for a sexual assault and intervention organization. It was the YWCA in Silicon Valley when I still worked over there. And that's where I really learned how to become a doula. They didn't really have, that's not what they called it. They didn't call it a doula. Yeah. We were trained as advocates or us. We were trained, part of the job was to be on the sexual assault response team. And so my job on that team was the advocate who would get called out at any hour of the day to mm-hmm. meet the survivor at the forensic clinic where the nurses were going to conduct the physical clinical exam of the assault. And so sometimes my clients were babies, and sometimes my clients were elderly men, you know, like
mm-hmm. in the range.
It doesn't discriminate, right? So I got to work with everybody. And so my job as an advocate was to, one, ensure that they knew what their rights were. The other was to advocate for them. If they didn't want the exam, then I was kind of that buffer with the detectives and the nurses. But if they wanted the exam, then it was, you know, holding their hands and walking them through the pictures and the collections and all of those things.
That's heavy work.
Very heavy. And then the other part of that was that I would accompany them to their detective interviews, and also to if it made it to the courtroom. In California, the only time that you can have somebody accompany you when you're up in the stand testifying is if you're a survivor of sexual assault. And so I got to go up on the stand with my clients when they would mm-hmm. when they would testify against their perpetrator. So that was short-lived for me, but maybe about a year. At that point, we moved down to San Diego, and I had maybe about a year to think about what I wanted to do. And I stayed, I lived the at-home mom kind of thing. I milked that for a year, but I knew I wanted to do something else. And I promised my now husband that I wouldn't do anything that was as stressful as gang intervention work or sexual assault work.
Super intense work, for sure.
I was like, I don't want to be witnessing that anymore, you know? Like, mm-hmm. yes, I know it exists, but I felt like, okay, for the better part of 10 years, I really dedicated my life to that. Mm-hmm. Prior to all of that too, Sabia, when I was in high school, I was hired by this program that was called Keep Your Freedom, Keep Your Dreams. Mm-hmm. And I think I was a senior in high school, and they hired me because I was a teen mom. And the whole premise around this program, this was a program by the Santa Clara County District Attorney. They were trying to lower teen pregnancy births or teen pregnancies, period, in our county. Well, their bright idea was that they could train teen parents to do public speaking and to go around to the high schools and pretty much scare people straight from having
sex. Yeah, I was going to say, this sounds like it's going to go some other way. And it did.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually, that was my very first job. And I was thrilled because before, you know, one of the other professions that has always kind of been like, maybe one day, has been to study law, to become an attorney. I want to be able to study law because I love to fight and argue.
Exactly.
So I was
looking up law school when I was living in San Diego.
How funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a great job opportunity for me because it was with the district attorney's office. And I think I was getting paid, like, I don't know, this was maybe 20 years ago. Like, I was getting paid $13 an hour, which was pretty good back then.
You must say you was balling.
Mm-hmm. And so I did that, you know, because I got paid. But in hindsight, the story that they taught us how to tell was pretty much a story of like, I fucked up. I had a baby. I regret it. You don't want to be like me. And so I think about this a lot of times, because just even the name of the program, Keep Your Freedoms, Keep Your Dreams, right? In a sense, they were telling us that we had lost our freedoms and we didn't have any access to our dreams anymore. We had given them up, which was complete and total bullshit, right? Mm-hmm. But I kind of like that subconsciously stayed with me for, I think, a long time. And still, you know, there's a lot of unprogramming, right? Mm-hmm. So every time I talk to my husband about the next thing that I want to study or the next training I want to take or the next license or certification I want to take, he has to remind me, you're enough. Like you, mm-hmm. like you're accomplished. What you do is amazing. You're mm-hmm. amazing. If you want to do that, okay. But
you don't have to.
You don't have to do any of that, right? And so I always remember that. Like, this is probably from my experience, you know?
Okay. Before I moved to San Diego, I worked with teen moms in like a group home shelter situation. And that was like, 5 years ago or something like that. I don't know what time is anymore, but I did that like 5 years ago for a year. And it's still that message that you're talking about, like that whole like keep your freedom, keep mm-hmm. your dream, is for sure still something that is infused into that whole like teen pregnancy experience. Mm-hmm. And like you said, it's all bullshit. And if you don't have anyone there to tell you that it's bullshit, I was there telling them that it was bullshit. By that time, I was already a doula too. So I was just like, mm-hmm. this is what you can do. These are your options. But like you said, if you don't, you know, if it's not available to you, you don't know, then it's just something mm-hmm. that becomes really, really ingrained.
Yeah, because it's the story that has been bought by an entire society, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where in reality, there was things about having my children at 16, at 22, that were so much easier than having them when I was in my 30s, you know? Mm-hmm. And those things are never talked about. They're never like exemplified. They're never celebrated, you know? But the truth is that being a good parent or a prepared parent, I mean, you probably have seen this, but it doesn't matter how much money you have, how many degrees you have. That does not make you more prepared.
But we know that, especially as birth mm-hmm. workers, right? Because like we've mm-hmm. been in those spaces where I've been in, you know, with a client who was low income, maybe not like, you know, resume wise, what people would deem as like a paired parent. And they mm-hmm. were a great parent, right? And they were ready to do whatever they mm-hmm. needed to do. And it was a beautiful experience. And I learned from them. And then mm-hmm. you have, you know, other households, especially when I was living in San Diego, that would have so much money, mm-hmm. have a great resume, have like all these things, all this access, all of, you know, like a dream situation, but we're not prepared in mm-hmm. any way.
Yeah. It's kind of like what I tell parents when they're asking me about, oh, can I have my toddler or my 3 or 4 year old, like at the birth, you know, will it be traumatizing, you know? And I try to remind them, like, you know, your 3, 4 year old, even your 10-year-old is less impacted by all of these false narratives that we see on the media, on the movies about birth than we are as adults. And so, and they're closer to actual birth, you know, they're in time wise, they're closer to that birth experience, you know, so it's not as foreign to them as we might think, because, mm-hmm. you know, we're maybe 30 years away from experiencing anything birth. Right.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that with teen parents or very young parents, a little bit of that is true as well. We don't have as much toxic information in our brain about mm-hmm. birth, you know, so we're there's a little bit of less junk in there.
Do you think that like your experience as a teen and becoming a parent at 16, do you think that's influenced your approach to midwifery? Mm. Like in your approach to like that kind of, you know, we always talk about as a birth worker, being open-minded, not being mm-hmm. judgmental, letting people parent in a way that they see fit. And that can be hard sometimes. But I also, you know, just thinking about your experience, feeling like maybe because you were at that space where you were dealing with so much criticism that you have the ability to kind of like empathize with your clients and their like growing process.
I mean, I think for one, you know, the kind of 16-year-old that I was wasn't, first, I don't know exactly how this happened. Maybe it was just the way that the stars aligned at birth, but I was very resilient. And so there was nothing that anybody could tell me that was going to set me back, you know? And so when I would hear these messages, for me, even though it was exhausting to hear the messages, for me, it was like, yeah, and that's not going to happen, you know? So there, a part of it, there was, you know, I had a big ego, a very big ego, that in a sense protected me from some of these like false narratives. But also I just didn't know what I didn't know, you know? And so I went into birth feeling invincible. Of course, that's not how it ended up, you know, like I was like, shit, this is hard. So birth for me really humbled me. It really humbled me from that place of nobody's going to mess with me. I'm strong. I know, you know, I know everything I need to know already. So for me, it was empowering in the sense that it humbled me enough to kind of ground me a little bit more and to, you know, remind me you don't know everything. Mm-hmm. You know, there are things that you don't know that you don't even know yet.
Yes, exactly. You know? Yeah.
So, you know, I scaled it back a little bit, but it was good because it allowed me to plan and focus a little bit better. And I think that served me well. But to answer your question, because I have had such a wide range of pregnancy and birth experiences throughout, you know, my youngest and oldest child are 21 years apart, you know? So who I was at 16 and then giving birth at 38 just recently gives me like a wide spectrum of different things that people could be going through, you know? So at the end of the day, midwifery requires a level of compassion that is so deep because you see people, literally growing and breaking down and making themselves back up and rebuilding their families. So that takes, you know, you have to look at that from a seat of extreme compassion. And anytime there is judgment, you know, you get humbled because then you see people, you see people's humanity.
Back with birth and just a process, even not just the actual birth, just the process. You see people's humanity on, and like when that judgment, for me, when that judgment like pops up, it makes me think about what am I not addressing within myself, right? For that judgment to be present. Like you're like, wait, it's not actually you. It really is me. And it like causes you to really work through your own shit in order to truly be present for the community that you're serving.
Right. Yeah. And it's birth work has a way of like I have certain groups of people who seem to find me in birth work. You know, like when you become a midwife or a birth worker, you're like, I'm going to be the midwife for this in this group or for this type of people or for these type, right? And let me just say, yes, you can decide that and you can market that all you want, but you need to realize that those folks are not always going to be the ones who are going to be asking for your services. And you might start seeing a particular group seek you out really often. And for me, I get people with high anxiety. I get people who have, you know, issues with trauma and trust and people who would be deemed high needs, right? Like a very needy client.
I can see that. I can see that with you for sure.
And I just, you know, I have to like always remind myself every time that that comes in, because my inner voice is like, oh no, again, why, why is this, why does this continue coming? You know, why do I continue having to work with this particular situation or topic, you know? And at one point, you know, I just kind of you know, surrendered to that and started taking these trauma-informed skills, because that's what was showing up in my practice.
So, okay. So one of the questions that I may have many questions for you, but thinking about that, thinking about like you attracting people that are more high needs, maybe dealing with anxiety and trauma, all of that. How does that manifest in your own body? Because midwifery in itself is just a very, like, I mean, it could be very taxing. It could be very loving. It could be great. It could be fulfilling. But it can also be very taxing on a physical level, emotional, spiritual, at least, like, you know, with birth work and as a doula, I'm always like, at birth, I'm just like, literally, this person is so open. Like, like, I'm just in their energy, right? And like, their energy may be great. Sometimes it may have some little ripples in there that we have to work through, but it can be very exhausting physically, mentally, all those ways. So like, with you having and attracting those types of clients, like, how do you like deal with that? Like, on a physical, mental level?
Well, it's been a learning process for sure. You know, in the beginning, when I was in apprenticeship and doulaing and working with, you know, my preceptor's clients in the apprenticeship, I didn't really have much of an option for lots of different reasons, mostly financial. You know, we have a big family, so I had to work, right? I had to work to get through the apprenticeship. Once I got my midwifery practice going, it was, you know, it was a good solid 2 years figuring out what a good flow for me was. And so I started with wanting to have 3 to 5 births a month. You know, I thought that would be a good flow for me. It was not much, but that's because I would take up to 4 doula clients and still apprentice. So I was used to this really high speed, you know, so coming out of apprenticeship, I was like completely in like fight or flight mode. And it took about 2 years before I could like wind back down. It took my husband almost wanting to divorce me. And he gave me an ultimatum. He says, "You're taking 2 weeks off and we're going on this road trip to Canada." And that time in nature and that time in not being with my phone and being able to sleep 8 hours a day straight for 15 days really reprogrammed my brain. And it made me realize, yeah, this isn't going to work. This is not working. This high speed and all of these high needs and all of these issues, all of these transfers, this stress, this overwhelm. So from there, I started scaling back. And right now I see 1 or 2 clients a month, 1 or 2 birth clients a month. For me, that's the way to go. The amount of work, the amount of attunement that goes into working one-on-one with a birth person or somebody who is going through so much and just all of that takes time and work. Not just at the prenatal visits, not just the charting and the administrative work that goes with it. Like they, you know, even though I come home, I'm thinking about them. Yes, I'm thinking absolutely. About how, you know, how can I support this person? You know, they're in my sphere of
absolutely, and they're close.
They're in my emotional, like, it's kind of like my daughters, like they're out of the home now, but I'm always thinking about them. I'm always like wanting to prepare to support them because I know that in 2 months they're not going to have enough money for rent again, you know? Yeah. So that's kind of how I am with my birth clients. And I could only do that for 1 or 2 families a month. And that's so far, that's been the best solution.
Yeah. And I'm like, definitely like echoing on so many levels that like that slowdown that has to happen. Like I was in, you know, as a doula, I remember this 1 month I had 5 clients and never again. I was like, never again. And then at one point I was like in the midwifery school process and I was working with Andrea and I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. I still have to do my doula work. I still have, because the school has to be paid for. Things have to happen. Everything has to happen at the same time. And for me, it wasn't working. Like I like physically, I couldn't handle it. Mentally, I was in collapse. Like it was just a bad situation. And so that's when I decided to step back and I, you know, raised my prices, did these things so that I could do exactly what you're talking about, have 1 to 2 clients per month, and be able to be like the like healthiest version of myself instead of like depleted and tired. My body hurts. I don't really know what the fuck is going on. Like, you know, like, and I was like, I don't want to be present. Can I physically be present at these 5 births? Yeah, for sure. But was I mentally present? Was I really aware? Was I really, you know, in a space that was beneficial for them? Probably not, right? Not even probably. I wasn't. So like that definitely made me shift. But the one thing too that stood out about what you said was that kind of fight or flight because of like the midwifery school process of just being in school. And most people do have to work and doula and do whatever. And then having your family and then going to birth in the middle of the night and having clinics the next day and like all of that. So one of the things that I've been like, it's just been like my own, I guess, conversation around midwifery school, whether it's like out of hospital or in hospital midwifery school. It's just that it's like, to me, it's kind of a fucked up process. Like, it when I personally decided to opt out, because I just really literally like physically and mentally can't handle it. And I had to be okay with that. And for the people that were handling it, I was like, wow, you're amazing. But also, you probably shouldn't be up for 72 hours. You know, like, you know, you probably shouldn't like, you know, not be eating well or not being able to spend time with your family, or you probably, you know, it was just like all these elements. So I was like, damn, like the calling to midwifery is such a strong one and like is needed and is necessary. But damn, the process is like, it's a lot. So I guess like your thoughts on that.
Well, my thoughts are that you're absolutely right. And I think anybody who has gone through midwifery school, whether they've completed or not, can attest to that. There's a lot of issues with our midwifery school education, like so many, you know, everything from like a lot, like the apprenticeship is modeled off of a very patriarchal, misogynistic systems, you know? And so that's not good. Right. So just even for me, like reframing preceptorship and reframing my relationship with my apprentices on how to make things sustainable for my practice, but a place where my students can thrive, you know, where they can they can thrive. And all of that, you know, I had to take a really hard look at that to see how I could make that good for all of us. Right. But midwifery is not what it was. Like we have to, it's a sad thing, you know, but midwifery has not been passed down from, you know, you're not learning it from your grandmother anymore. Yeah. You're not learning it from your sister or from your, we
had like generational approach
or just even the communal approach. Like, where my father is from, the nearest hospital is a 5-hour drive. They live up in the mountain, rural, super rural areas. It's not even accessible for 4 months out of the year because the rains don't allow you to travel in or out. So all of the women there, when I would ask them about the parteras, they'd be like, well, you know, everybody was kind of a partera because first of all, everybody was having a dozen children, the truth. But it was pretty much like you would just kind of call your neighbor. You would call your neighbor and everybody was kind of had the, it was a basic skill set, right? And so that's not in the context that we live in anymore, you know? So we also can't romanticize it like that because if that time ever comes back, our context has to completely change. I think, you know, we are trying to function in a system that is just oppressive in nature, you know? And for those of us who have made it through, of course, we want to say, yeah, but it's doable. You can do it and it's needed. But I do think it's toxic for folks to say like, oh, well, you know, it's only for like, it's only for the strong ones or, you know, I guess you just weren't cut out for the work, you know? And that's part of that like fucked up narrative, you know?
It is. If we're also like, I remember when I was like questioning that and like, obviously like I love all the midwives things that I was like in conversation with, but when I would like kind of like, you know, say like, hey, this is kind of fucked up. Like I'm exhausted. How am I supposed to be able to maintain this for a long period of time without killing myself, literally? And they were like, you'll figure it out. And I'm like, yeah, but does that yeah, maybe. But like when I figure it out, what will that do to my mental health, to my physical well-being? Like where will my relationship be, right? Like, mm-hmm. So that, like, I know, like, I mean, doulas and midwives, like, have a kind of, like, high, I don't feel like high percentage of divorce, but, like, it's a thing, right? Like, yeah, it's a thing. So it's, like, I know that we, like, we are in this oppressive system that, you know, like, which is the reason for why these things are existing the way that they're existing. But I also feel like what you said was so important around, like, not romanticizing, like, what used to be versus where we are now, and not, like, doing the whole, like, the strong survive, or mm-hmm. because that just like pushes this narrative that pushes more and more people out. And not only that, it's like already dealing with midwifery, we have, you know, a lack of Black, Brown, Indigenous people mm-hmm. able to get through the process. And it's like not about the strong ones, quote unquote. It's about the system being fucked up and not having space or making mm-hmm. space for people to get through.
Or the most privileged survive.
Exactly.
The most exactly. privileged make it, you know? And for me, it's, you know, I recognize that I had certain privileges that my counterparts didn't, right? And for me, my biggest privilege was being married to a cis male who gets a cis male salary, mm-hmm. you know? And even though it was difficult for us financially, his salary covered our basic need. You know, there wasn't a question about, are we going to make rent? Are we going to have enough food? Are we going to have enough to put in our gas tanks? Like those basic needs were met. And mm-hmm. So I had that privilege that really carried me through, you know, and that's a very real thing. That's mm-hmm. a very real thing. And not everybody has that. You know,
I definitely didn't. I was like, mm-hmm. I was like at the time, like, you know, doing a whole midwifery thing. And I had a lot of like people who were like, oh, my partner is supporting me, or, you know, and mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that's really nice. But that is not the case here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I personally decided to step away for like my own sustainability and like literally for keeping my mind somewhat stable. Mm-hmm. But what would you say to the, you know, person who is excited and wanting to go into midwifery, or the person who's even maybe in the process, what would you say to them about like self-preservation, about yeah. boundaries around that, and like just surviving yeah. the process?
You know, I think that for many careers, possibly, like, I feel like people will sometimes just kind of like take that leap out of like love and passion and excitement and spontaneity. Midwifery is not a career that you can do that with. There mm-hmm. is a lot of shadow work that has to be done first, and there's a lot of preparation that needs to go into it. And so I tell people who want to go into midwifery is to really explore birth work, whether that be through doulaing, they have to see those sides. They have to see what it's like, you know, even if they don't mm-hmm. want to practice in a hospital, they need to see what hospital birth is like. They have to have interactions with unhappy clients. They have to mm-hmm. they have to experience their life with birth work first. And then if that is something that they're still jiving with, then we can start thinking about midwifery school. But for me, one of the things that was the most important thing was that I had very clear boundaries in my apprenticeship. My boundaries are very much like, I could only attend 3 to 4 births a month. These are the days that I will have childcare. These are the days I can come into clinic. And I feel like if you don't know how to have a clear conversation about your boundaries with your preceptor, that's going to be a really difficult situation mm-hmm. because a lot of preceptors right now, they're still operating under that hierarchy. Like, let's see if you're tough enough to make it through. How bad do you want this? Put your big girl panties on. And it's kind of like a hazing that happens. People going into midwifery, you know, also going into midwifery, there's this like other side that hardly gets talking about, but it's not just about babies being born. There's also that shadow side where there is a lot of death and there's a lot of grief as well. Mm-hmm. Not maybe physical deaths by babies or moms, but we know that also to happen. And so being able to accept those both sides. And if you can't even talk about death, if you can't even talk about babies dying or moms dying, then that's probably a sign that there's still work that you need to do before you accept midwifery in your path, you know?
And so we briefly, before we like got on officially, we talked about like that toxic connection to midwifery. So could you just give us a little of that, little judge?
Different people come into midwifery for lots of different reasons, but many times it's because of a personal experience that they've had. Either they had a bad birth experience or they had an amazing birth experience. But I feel like there's in midwifery school and even within apprenticeship, we hardly ever talk about our own personal relationship to birth work, right? And I mentioned to you that I feel like midwifery can be that like love of your life, but also be a very toxic relationship. So for me, midwifery is like my other lover. Like I love it so much. You know, it's, I know I'm good at what I do. I get a high off of seeing people's lives change, you know, like that feels really good for me. But that other side, that shadow work also means that sometimes I'm putting midwifery in front of other things, right? Am I putting this one love of my life in front of my husband? You know, I've done that many times. It's almost cost me my marriage. In my everyday life, you know, I have to ground myself and remind myself, you're not at work, Thema. It's time to feed your kids. It's time to get dressed. Stop daydreaming about midwifery, about your clients,
it's about so the updates. Hard, on though, the- especially when you love your work. It's so hard because I was talking to my therapist. And so like one of my goals is literally like the separation of like CEO Sabia and doula Sabia and like all these other identities from like Sabia, you know, like, and it's hard when you like really love what you do. But like you said, that balance of saying, okay, what is the priority? What is this getting in front of? Where's the balance so that I'm not in this? Cause like, you know, I don't know how it is for you, but like work for me, because I love it so much, is an easy distraction from real shit that's happening.
Yep.
Absolutely. I'm like, I love my job. I'll just go work.
Yeah. And then we think it's for us, it's like work is important, right? Because
I'm making at change. Least for my... I'm making impact.
Right. I'm sustaining, you know, I'm feeding my family. I'm, you know, all of these things that, you know, if you come from a childhood where there was, where you didn't have basic needs met, you know, then really we're operating from our trauma response, right? My trauma response of, I don't ever want to be evicted again. My trauma response of, I don't want to like miss another payment, you know, my
trauma response of like, I don't want someone's birth to be as bad as mine was.
Exactly. Or what is it going to mean about me if this birth doesn't, is not so good. Well. If this VBAC isn't, you know, result in a vaginal birth. There's so many like toxic things that can go on with your relationship. So this is my, this is how we know if the relationship is toxic versus fruitful and good for you, you know, in regards to your midwifery relationship. When you are in a healthy relationship, the rest of your life improves. Like it enhances your life. When you are in a toxic relationship, it doesn't enhance your life and it can harm it. So is your relationship with birth work enhancing the relationship that you have to the actual beings, present beings in your life? Or is it harming it, right? I sometimes I joke about this, but when my friends are like, when am I going to get to see you? When are we going to hang out? And I'll joke around and I'll say, when are you getting pregnant again? You know? And we laugh, right? Like, ha, 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 ha. But that's some really fucked up stuff right there.
That is. Because
it's saying, I really only have time for you if you are living out my wildest dream of being a midwife and serving people and catching your baby.
I want to show up when I feel like I'm going to be the hero. Like I want to show when I'm going to be like, you know, the person, the helper, when I have a bigger role in what's happening.
So if you're there and I've been there, you know, and I still go there to those places, then that's a sign that your this toxic relationship needs some fine tuning, you know. But if midwifery is, you know, if you're at a place with midwifery where everything else is being enhanced, right? Like for me, the things that have enhanced in my life has been, I've been able to relate better with my sisters. I've been able to relate better with my mother. You know, the things that I've learned in midwifery have enhanced my communication skills with them. It's enhanced my relationship to other women, mm-hmm. you know, like learning how to collaborate with them, learning how to be more compassionate. But it's also enhanced my relationship to the earth and wanting to learn more about how can I learn to take care of my health better through my relationship with plants and food and mm-hmm. nature and those kinds of things, right? So there has to be, you know, nobody's perfect, but if you're more on that toxic side, then there has to be, I encourage you to pause and really examine that. And to seek support. It's like anything else. When you're in an abusive relationship, mm-hmm. it's hard to get out by yourself. You have to have support. So just like Savia has a therapist, I have a therapist too.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like, for sure. Yeah. And I think also just add on to what you were saying, it's like, it's that like realizing that you're possibly more in a toxic space, right? With your relationship to midwifery or birth work in general. And taking that pause or even having that realization can be really hard, because I feel like doulas who are like in that toxic space tend to be around other doulas who are in that toxic space, right? And they tend mm-hmm. to kind of feed each other the words of affirmation to continue to be in that toxic space. So, you know, like it just wanting to like name that, and that sometimes there is like, when I decided that I didn't want to do certain stuff, I didn't want to like, you know, just burn myself out all the time. There was a point in that pause where I felt really isolated. Like I felt mm-hmm. like my decision to go about my work differently was not necessarily not accepted, but it was like, I don't know what you're doing, so I'm gonna keep doing what I'm doing. And mm-hmm. like there was that time of like, what the hell is going on? But, you know, when I, like you said, building that positive side to your work, to midwifery, it was the same thing for me where I was like, hey, how can this be used in a way that brings me happiness and joy and balance? And part of it was like, if I'm talking all this shit to my clients about taking care of themselves, how can I not be doing the same thing? Like that was like yeah. a basic thing that made me kind of like flip the way that I was relating to birth work.
Yeah. And you know, it's getting time for me to feed the baby, but I mm-hmm. want to just say this one last thing too, is that, you know, here in the Western world, we have names and roles for everything, right? Like, oh, you know, a NICU nurse is different from a labor and delivery nurse in mm-hmm. this way. And a doula is different than a midwife in this way, right? We have like these, mm-hmm. these boxes, right? And it's very linear. And it's not really the way that midwifery, for the lack of a better word, operated. So whereas right now, what you're doing, Savia, you know, you are educating, you are training, right? You are inspiring. That was also a part of what our matriarchal woman doctors did back in the day. Mm-hmm. Maybe because, you know, it just didn't fit their capacity to actually attend the births, but it doesn't mean that you cannot contribute to birth work in other ways. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, whereas mm-hmm. right now my capacity is to be with people as they're giving birth, my capacity is to be with the babies being born, that might shift in 5, mm-hmm. 10 years. And I might become more of the educator or more of the,
hi, Mundo.
Or more of the person who's supporting with the plant medicine. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, I think we need to be okay with, you know, that maybe your midwifery path or your birth work path is different, right? So honoring mm-hmm. where we're at in our life with our capacities, what our gifts are, and knowing that we don't have to fit in these boxes. And just because we don't fit in these boxes doesn't mean that our work and our contribution isn't as needed and as important.
Thank you for that. Because literally when I decided to listen to my body, my brain, my actual needs, as soon as I did that, shit just flipped. Like shit just like took off. Cause it was like, hey, the way that you were contributing at that point was good for you then, But in order for you to be on this next journey, you gotta, it has to look different. Mm-hmm. It has to look different. And it has looked different. And, you know, I had like those struggles around, like, for me to be a doula, should I be out of birth every day? You know? But now I'm like, I'm an educator. You know, that's what I do. And like, and I love it. So I'm just so appreciative. One of your time, two of your wisdom, three of Mundo and all his like chunky cuteness. And I know that like, also just naming that you are like 4.5 months postpartum, midwifing, wifing, mothering, like educating, doing all this shit, and you are doing it well. And I just appreciate the time that you gave me, for sure.
Yeah. Thank you, Savia. I mean, it's all, there's definitely days where I'm over my capacity and it's not working, right? Mm-hmm. But I try to only do things that really do feel good. Does it feel good to be on whatever the witchy mama's wellness hippie podcast? No, that doesn't feel good to me. Does it feel good to hop on, you know, still in my pajamas with Sabia and their podcast? That feels a little better, right? So
thank you. How can people reach you?
I have a website. It's mostly dedicated to expecting birthing people. It's lamatrizbirth.com. And then I'm pretty active on my social media on Instagram. I go by Matriz Midwife. Matriz is like matrix, but with instead of an X, you use a Z. Matriz Midwife.
Yeah. And that's what you see Mundo.
Yes. Mundo's my Instagram co-star.
For sure. You do like when you both are just laying there, his face is right there and you're looking like just like twins. I'm like, okay.
Like, yeah. Sure. I finally made one that looks like me.
Yeah. Well, your oldest daughter looks just like you.
Yeah. So my oldest and my youngest are my mini-me's.
Yeah, your oldest daughter looks just like you. But for sure, thank you so much for your time. And I'm grateful for all the work that you do, because I've definitely learned from you, especially in my time. I remember, first of all, me and we did a birth together, which was like amazing, such a treat. But I remember the first time I met you, like you came to that event that I did, like the POC birth worker event. And I remember like, I think you messaged me or you like changed it on Facebook and said that you were coming. And I was like, oh shit. And I started telling everyone like, oh shit. So it was just like super exciting. So I remember like that first, which is like, you know, 3-4 years ago now, something like that, until where we are now. And we're still in relationship and we're still present with each other in some type of way. So I just appreciate that.
Yeah, it's been so much fun. Yeah. Yeah, so many fun memories, Sabia. Really feel inspired by all your work and just keep doing what you're doing. I'm happy to support in the little ways that I can. And
we'll keep doing the work together. Yeah. We just got to keep taking breaks and like, you know, listening to our bodies and, you know, all of that. But thank you.
Okay, have a good rest of your day. Hugs. Bye.